whole thing about you being childlike, which crops up obviously endlessly. But nobody, as far as I can see, looking through the cuttings and everything, nobody's ever actually asked you why you think you've remained childlike. I mean, is there a point in your development where you kind of made a conscious decision that you didn't want to grow up?
And if so, no, I think it's a real misconception. I think people fool themselves. It's kind of like a... It comes across in interviews because people want me to be childlike. I mean, there's... Because of what I've done, I've allowed... And I've been lucky, but I mean, there's an element of that. But I mean, I've kind of been fortunate, if there's any difference. I've helped to put myself in a position where I can keep part of my life as being very childlike. To an outsider, that's a casual observer, I have like nothing to worry about. But in fact, I run like the whole thing. I like take all decisions relating to everything. And it's like, I don't have anyone looking after me. I'm childlike. I am in respect of my outlook on life. But I don't even think it's childlike because I'm like horribly aware of like the pitfalls of life and like the meanness of people, which children aren't. You know, children are like naive and like blindly innocent and just like enjoy things for what they are. I mean, I don't have that kind of childlike naivety anymore. But I'm determined not to be ground down by a notion of adult life, which I've never subscribed to and never will. I mean, I feel like I can do all the things that I do and take all the decisions I make and still retain a part of me as, you know, I protect it. I just keep it away from which people say, oh, you're able to because you don't have to work. But, you know, I always dispute that because, I mean, I really love what I do, but it still can be quite hard. You know, it's like working like on something for 20 hours, like I don't have to, and that's the whole point. No one's telling me to do anything. I mean, I can say, like, we'll pack up now and go home, that's it, so, you know, it's finished. Even that decision that like rests with me, but so there's no one kind of like forcing me to clock on. But at the same time, I mean, I work because I enjoy it, but I do work, and children don't work. So I do know what it alludes to, and I think everyone that is around me and the people that I really get on with have that same kind of a sense of wonder. I mean, it manifests itself in different ways. So like with Perry and I have astronomy in common, and that to me is a way of like retaining like a childlike sense of wonder, because I don't think you can ever get too old to kind of like just be awed by looking at the stars and Perry's the same, and so he has that. But at the same time, I mean, he's written, you know, he's dead grown up in other ways. It's like he lives, you know, he looks after himself as well. So it's a kind of it's a mixture of misconception, and I suppose a certain amount of artifice as well on my part to kind of project that idea of, you know.
Is it part of this difference between childlike and childish that childlike is actually something that is quite desirable in people? I think.
Yeah.
Whereas childish.
Yeah.
Really isn't. Well, childish is the tantrum.
Yeah, people always... childlike is very rarely used, and people that you use like want to like slag us off or slag me off, they will use childish. Without ever having met me, of course. But even that, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, being childish is all right, you know, if you do it around people that can put up with it.
But that's why they say you can afford to do it, isn't it? To do it around people that can put up with it. No, I think part of it also is that in songs you're able to look at the world with that kind of I was going to say innocence, but I don't actually believe there is such a thing as innocence.
I mean, that's why some by artifice, and it's too strong a word because it's almost about that it seems like I'm contriving it. But I mean, but I'm only ever moved to write words about anything from a sense of like either, you know, I mean, from extremes of emotion, and that is a childlike quality, and that's what I mean by that. That is ground down in people as they get older, usually, unless something really tragic happens, and then people kind of move to tears for a day, maybe, and then they kind of like just sink back into the, you know, their normal state of being, which I have resisted. I mean, I would hate to just to feel that I'd reached a point where I was no longer moved to write about anything. Whether it be But that's, I mean, it's something that I've you know, I'm kind of prepared for.
A lot of people feel they can't function in their lives if they leave themselves open to stuff like that. But
Which again, people would say, I'm lucky because I can. You know, that it doesn't matter if I burst into tears because people think, oh, he's just crying. You know?
Well, in a sense, your ability to have an income is founded on your ability to remain open.
It's a strange paradox, isn't it?
If you couldn't do that, then you would be a labourer or whatever.
Or I'd be writing songs about, I mean, there's an awful lot of people who write songs that don't have emotional content in them, they're just kind of songwriters. Mm. And I mean, I could do that. Mm. It wouldn't be anywhere near as much fun, but I mean, say like what we've accomplished in like the last 10 weeks. Yeah, it's and I mean, on this side of Christmas, it's really what we've been doing. I mean, I've been kind of like structuring the songs and making sure they work, you know, tonally and like tempo wise, where they go, what happens to them. But the stuff I'll be doing after Christmas is like what I do on my own, which is like the words and the singing, which kind of makes the song into something hopefully more than it is at present. It's not just like a piece of music becomes a song. But I mean, writing music and writing words, there are things that can be contrived. I mean, I have been guilty of it in the past. It's not a great sin, but I like playing with my nieces and nephews, and that helps.
Michael Jackson got into terrible trouble.
Yeah, but my nieces and nephews are a pretty hard bunch. Plus, I'm not Michael Jackson.
I don't believe he did it, actually.
No.
I don't believe he did it.
I honestly haven't really spent enough time to form an opinion.
Yeah, I just don't.
So I don't. There's no point because Simon's like so dead certain that he did. That
really?
That he just goes mad at the mention of his name. So, I just play the albums now.
I think he just lives in such another world that he would actually get.
You know what?
With
yeah.
I must admit, when it first came out, I thought, well, what's wrong? I mean, I would never do it. I suppose because I'm not. You know, I'm not in another world like him, but I can actually take a step back and think, yeah, well, I can understand why he would. The only people he could trust would be people who would trust him back and not want anything from him apart from his friendship. And the only people that are going to do that are going to be like young kids.
You know, though, but speaking of Make-A-Wish, I have lots of friends that have met him and spent time at his house and spent. Yeah. It's just absolutely nothing. All you hear is that it was so good to them, and you know.
I know. Well, I don't think that he would like set up. I mean, it's a pretty fucking elaborate setup just to like get into bed with someone.
And also, he's got so many people around.
Inviting like loads and like thousands of people around.
Just from the people I've heard.
Right, wacko. He's like, I think they should leave him alone.
He's a strange person, I think, but you know, an unusual person.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't envy him. I wouldn't be him to like. He's got everything.
It's a horrific life, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's in some ways, he's got nothing. I mean, and that's kind of like ripped away. Like what. Because now we can't even have the friendships of children because their parents were like him. I mean, in some ways, what's been done to him is quite evil, really.
I think so.
That's what I think.
I feel sorry for him, but I mean, I can't believe he's guilty, really.
All I've ever heard from Make-A-Wish and all the people I know is wonderful things.
Don't put your daughter on the stage, Mrs. Worthington. It's right. I think, you know, to cram a child into that kind of existence at 5, which is what happened to him.
Yeah. It's hardly surprising.
It's criminal. Still, enough of this.
Simple on Michael Jackson.
How did we get there?
Being an uncle, rather than a father, I think this helps keep me child. I think if I'd taken it and had children, I think I probably would have. I think my responsibilities would have become too great for me to be quite as childish, childlike as I am. Because having said all that about taking decisions and stuff, I still feel that I'm not sort of responsible to anyone, but I don't expect that. I'm taking decisions that would affect other people, but I take them in good faith, kind of thing. I think about other people, but I don't feel that they should hold me down to being responsible for their lives. Which is one of the things that I'm doing this, I've realised over the last 3 months, that does wear away at your childlike qualities. Every decision that you make, whether it be like what food you're going to have from the table onwards, it's like someone's going
to
be unhappy somewhere, and I have to kind of get the blame for it. So, but it's all right, but then if you just laugh.
I have nothing to do with that. This question isn't here, but it's relevant to where we are. I mean, how did you come to be recording in here? I mean, is Jane Seymour's house sort of on the market as a place where bands can come and record? And how did that happen?
No. Well, after before the Wish album, I wanted to buy our own stuff, like enough equipment to record wherever we wanted. We were actually going to go on a boat in just somewhere and just record on a boat, kind of sail around England on a boat. But the costs involved were actually quite astronomical once we started to investigate it practically, and it would cost like more than recording 5 albums in a studio. So we ended up like the best second option, which was the Manor, which was like really nice, you know, very kind of locked away from the world. You get everything you want. But at the end of it, we walked away, and I kind of felt, there's another group following us in. And in some ways, it upset me. And I also thought, well, it's pretty stupid because, in fact, at the time, it wasn't stupid.
Well, like the next group was invading your home or whatever. Yeah,
that we'd kind of made it ours. Yeah. So like we were there for 6 months, and then
remember
we
you
were
decorated
like,
it all this stuff.
Yeah,
you? Yeah.
But we were like, you know, discarded and forgotten. Like the next week, I mean, we actually weren't, because like most of the staff got sacked when we left. But I couldn't really afford to buy what we needed, because this is like 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Technology was such that I would have needed like an Arctic truck to carry everything around, and like substantially more money than I'd earned at the time. Whereas now, the equipment, I mean, everything that's in this house I've bought, and it costs less than it would to spend like 3 months at the Manor. Mm-hmm. So it just, apart from anything else, it makes economic sense. But more importantly, it meant that I could then look around. I spent like a lot of this year just kind of travelling around looking for the right place to record. Mm-hmm. So I went to like loads of different houses. And this was actually just by chance, because this is on the market to be sold. And I heard about it from someone, and they sent me a cutting that was in some magazine. And I just thought it looked really brilliant. And it had a description of the ballroom and the orange room. And I thought, sounds a good house. So I came along just to like view it, and in that intervening period, because we did the demos with, as well as gradually buying the equipment, we were doing demos in an old, like really run down house in East Sussex, and we were actually going to do the album there, but it was about a quarter of the size of this, and it was not the same kind of scope, but big enough to, you know, it had two big enough rooms to do what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. Although the recording room is about this size, as opposed to like, I don't know if you've seen the ballroom room.
Yeah,
like.
Lovely.
But
and that's the library that we were in, presumably, where the mixing was
going on. Yeah. So I thought, well, you know, I'll fall back into this, into the house in East Sussex, but if I can find somewhere better, then we'll go somewhere better. And the people that were renting the house in East Sussex actually took on this house as Jane Seymour's agents. So it's just like one of those strokes of good fortune.
So you didn't actually know Jane socially or anything?
No, I've never spoken to her.
Right.
I still haven't spoken to her. All been invited to her music party.
Did she come on
the phone? She called.
Yeah. Hi, Jane.
Yeah. Jane. She says, this is Jane Seymour calling.
One of the great disappointments of my life, that woman. I remember the first time I saw pictures of her, I thought, gosh, she's gorgeous. And then the more you hear about her, the less you like her.
Yeah.
Still.
So I mean, when I came here to see it, I mean, it was just like a big old house. There's like no one. She doesn't live here, and it just seemed really tragic. I mean, he walked in, it just was, you could feel it was like really cold and sort of. But I mean, since we've all been here, it's kind of come alive. You know, the whole house is just like a really excellent place to be, and it's perfect. But the thing is, it's just too well known to buy it. I mean, everyone knows that we're here. And that's around 20 miles, it seems, knows we're here. Although we haven't really been that bothered.
You're not been pestered.
No. But the trouble, because the church is just there and it's like public access and stuff, it's not really that private. It's fine when we're all here, but I don't really fancy living with the group for the rest of my life. I love them dearly, though.
But I think a place this size needs lots of people in it, doesn't it? And in the old days, it would have had, wouldn't it?
Me and Mary actually came here for the first 2 weeks of our let just on our own, because I wanted to come in and kind of sort things out and figure out what we were going to do, and then just get used to the house. And it was pretty uncomfortable, sort of It's not. I mean, we lived in the library. We lived in the library or the kitchen. You know, scuttled between the two rooms. We never came. I didn't even know this room existed until the group came here. So it's like it's hopeless because we're like living with Mary, just the two of us. It's really nice. We've got just like a normal sized house. And, you know, having said that, it's excellent for everyone to be here like for a period of like 3 or 4 months. And it also means that we can kind of work how we want. And there isn't another group coming in afterwards. So she's just going to sell the house. So that's kind of like...
If she sells the house, happy to record it.
Well, no, we've got it up until March.
Oh, right.
And then we've been kicked out. But though, so I must say that she got, she gave us a price for it and then was offered about 5 times that price for letting it to an American company. And she stood by her verbal agreement
with us.
So she's English in that. No offence, but I don't think she'd been American. They wouldn't have been.
There
wouldn't have been a contest.
Yeah, no, that's nice. It's nice. It'd be nice to. So, might be able to put something nice about her in the book. I'd rather.
Yeah.
If you're going to put anything about her,
she has such a nice name.
Yeah. No, I don't. I mean, I feel a bit better. I don't think
they are. I just get the impression.
Her son likes this apparently. Plays trumps. He was keen for us to be here.
Oh, how old is he?
Her children were actually here the first time I was supposed to come here to view the house, and I got here really late, and they had to go, they had to leave.
So. You'll have to send them a copy of the album.
Yeah.
When it's finished.
Well, the house might actually be on the album cover. We've got arty photo in mind of her. An Anton Corbin sort of.
That's fair, she'll demand the extra 4 fifths.
Yeah. talk of my house appearing on the album.
When did that actually start? You said you and Mary came here at the beginning of the let. When was the beginning of the let?
The last week in September. The last 2 weeks because we had a party. So it's Mary's birthday at the start of October, and we had a party with her family, and then the group arrived the next day.
Right. Okay.
So, however long that is. I think it's 12. I think it's 3. Yeah, it's 12 weeks this side of Christmas and 9 weeks the other side.
Okay. These questions are kind of zipping about backwards and forwards. There's no chronology to these. They're just things that came up while I was compiling the chronology, and I just kind of stuck them at the back. So let's go for the solo album. When you were working on it, before it mutated into Disintegration, was the band afraid that they were being deserted? And obviously I'm going to ask them this question as well.
No, because I think... Well, I think the only members of the band that would care if they were being deserted would probably Simon. I don't really think the others would have seen it that way. I don't think Boris, Roger or Paul kind of thought of The Cure as in the same way. I think they probably would have thought he's doing a solo album, he'd get it out of his system, and then we'll do an album. I don't think they're really worried. I think Simon would have been.
Simon would have been able to see it more as a kind of personal.
Yeah, I think he would have seen it. He would have got very paranoid that, you know, I didn't like the group, so I was doing a solo album.
Because in a way, he's closest to you.
Yeah, and kind of, and I think probably sees the group in a similar way to how I see it, which is sort of more than a group.
Wow, it's Jane calling.
It's Jane again.
It's Roberta.
I don't think that.
It's Roberta.
Paul Flack.
It's Roberta.
I don't think Paul, Boris, or Roger. I mean, I think they would admit it as well. I never really thought of the group as anything more than a group. You know, it didn't really symbolise anything, represent anything. It was just. It was. I'm not being horrible. It wasn't like.
I'm wondering in what sense you mean it, because it sounds like a job or work.
in some respects, I think it was, particularly to Roger and Paul. I don't really think they ever thought that like culturally or in any sense, the group had very much significance.
Mm-hmm.
They liked other things much more than they liked The Cure. Whereas with me and Simon, we don't really like anything more than we like The Cure. We don't like any other group more than we like The Cure. And I honestly don't. I mean, I think when we do things that are really, really good, they're as good or better than anyone else does things. I mean, we do bad things, but there is no other group that I think does consistently does things better than we do. So, and if I did, I'd be really, it'd be terrified. I'd be like, I mean, I wouldn't be doing a solo album. I wouldn't be working with the group. Mm. I think Perry sees the group in the same way as me. So Perry sees things very, very much how I do about the group, because he was like a fan of the group and kind of understands the group does mean things to certain people. I mean, like globally, a handful of people, but you're always aware, you know, that if you let yourself down, you're also letting those people down as well. And whereas I don't think Boris, Roger or Paul would ever believe that, whether they would ever grasp the idea, because they liked things that were, you know, that were kind of very different. So I don't think they felt deserted at all. I mean, I shied away from the idea of a solo album because I felt it was too much work and too kind of solitary. It's almost like writing. Because effective disintegration was an awful lot of it. I treated it as a solo album anyway. But I just had people around. That sounds really callous as well. I mean, everyone played on the record apart from Noel, and played really well. I mean, without Roger, I mean, everyone derides Roger now, but without Roger, Disintegration wouldn't have been a patch in the album that it is, because his keyboard player is excellent. Sounds like Homesick and that. We'd never done an album with competent keyboard playing before, and I think he really added a dimension. But he did it without really understanding what was going on internally. You know, I don't think he really grasped what the songs were about.
That's perfectly possible, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't bother me. It doesn't bother me now. I mean, with Disintegration, I had a very, very strong idea of what I wanted the record to sound like and what I wanted it to be like, and no one was going to get in the way of it, so I don't suppose they bothered. You know? They just kind of did what I wanted. Whereas with the Wish album, it's much more, you know, I kind of said, well, do what you want and I'll tell you if I like it. It was that sort of idea.
Different attitude. Yeah. I think it's nice that you take a different approach virtually for every album. You have a different kind of mental set.
Well, Disintegration was all, I was 29 when we started, 30 when we finished. And kind of, you know, I had a period of like, I think everyone does it at a certain age. You get like a keystone age sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then I kind of went through a period of a month in the middle of doing the album where I just went completely berserk. Like, not since I'd done since I was like in my early 20s. So I suppose, I mean, I distinctly remember being looked at very peculiarly by other members of the group. Kind of thinking, oh God, you know, what's he on now? and kind of playing up to it and thinking, yeah. And I felt very sort of left alone, but in a nice way. I think they felt sort of like, you know, protective towards me. But I remember just, I mean, I slept in the control room and stuff. I sort of lived the record for like 3 months. Yeah. But it's good. I mean, I think acting. I thought. I mean, it was going to be like, you know, like my last will and testament record. I think at the time.
What, you thought you were going to die, or?
Yeah, that's overly dramatic. I thought that was it. I thought that was the last Cure album. That was like, you know, that I'd kind of exhausted all the possibilities of what I could do lyrically and within that framework of like being Robert Smith of the Cure. I thought that was it.
I think that period around your 30th birthday is a period that deserves reasonably lengthy treatment in the book. Just judging by all the things you've said about it in other interviews and things, it keeps getting referred to, but it never gets expanded on, as it were. And there's a lot of things that you often refer to that don't get any bigger in the retelling. And I often think, I actually want to know more about that. So there'll be several things will come up that I've noticed you keep bringing up in interviews, but the interviewers don't seem to follow them. So I'm going to try and
focus on this. Personal point of view, I found it very strange because I always thought it would be 25, you know, because it's like a really crappy sort of rock and roll there. I don't want to stay alone at 25. But it's actually like the closer I got to 30, like through my 29th year, I just had a real kind of sense of doom.
Impending doom.
Which I could never shake, like for the whole year. I was kind of, and that's where like Disintegration was just born out of that feeling of like despair.
Where did you actually record Disintegration?
Outside studios.
Outside, and that's in Barks, isn't it?
Yeah, it's called Hookend Manor. It's called
Hookend Manor Barks.
Yeah. So it used.
What's the nearest town?
The nearest big town is Reading. Or it's actually what's the famous Henley.
Henley.
It's right next to Henley.
So it's near Henley.
George Harrison's house, apparently.
Did you pop it in?
Strangely enough, we didn't get invited there.
Okay. Because you talked about going out for a walk amongst the trees around where you were recording.
Yeah.
And I knew it was called Outside Studios or whatever it was, but I didn't know where that was. So I just wanted to
I mean, it's very similar in setting in the Strangelow to here.
Really?
I mean, it's a but a very, very different feel. I mean, the house is old, but it's been modernised, and the studio is all brand new, and it's really, really clinical, which I liked at the time. I thought it was really funny because it was kind of. I liked the idea of just being in there, as a transient, and then being forced to leave. It appealed to me, which I hate that at the moment.
The night of my 30th birthday. Right. Yeah. I mean, Disintegration. That album presumably goes back to this business of worrying about disintegration since you were 13. And the quote is on page 4, about halfway down, if you want to remember what you said about it.
Stop being back in court.
Hmm?
Stop being back in court. I refer you to page 4.
I refer you to that.
I didn't say that. Sorry. Overruled.
Misquoted. Yeah, I'll be hamburger. You're too young to remember pennies. Worrying about disintegration since you were 13. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, what happened when you were 13? Did something happen that made you start to worry about disintegrating? I mean, it is kind of a.
Yeah, going to big school, going to comprehensive. Mm-hmm. It kind of the real world or something like there. I was the first bunch of, you know, of the ones that went to middle school, and they invented that, like from 11 to 13, and it was dead arty and kind of like closeted existence.
So this funny English education system that I don't really understand.
You could do what you want, you know. It's like you could attend lessons if you felt like it. It's that sort of deal, you know. And suddenly, like going to a Roman Catholic comprehensive with a Nazi headmaster. It's just that. I think I'd, so it kind of sort of started me thinking about, you know, I mean, I'd been reading books up to that point, which hinted, you know, books that I shouldn't have been reading, sort of thing, my brother would give to me, that hinted at despair and disintegration. But that was all in the future.
Do you remember I want books to figure quite a lot throughout this book, because
I've been actually asked to do something, a book thing next year in East Anglia, Bedfordshire Books Fair or something.
To do what?
Desert Island Books, like to be interviewed on stage about 10 books I took to Desert Island. And I was thinking, God, I was desperately trying to think of like the books that I've read. Because I've been moving all my books at home, like, and then there's like hundreds of paperbacks. I think I've read all these, and I started looking at the spines of something. I can't remember what this is about. It's really terrifying. But the thing is, if you worry too much about that, it's like you would never read again. You never do anything because you just like despair. You can't possibly remember. I don't know. I mean, I was going to say Beowulf, but I was trying to think what.
That's quite a
disparaging
book.
I mean, it struck me. I didn't really understand what was occurring. I remember him reading it to me when I was about 9 years old, and just feeling really uncomfortable. Like, he used to come and ask my dad had read this, you know, like the Grimm's Fairy Story. So my brother kind of come and go, read your kind of page from Beowulf, because he was doing it, you know, at college. And I sort of go to sleep with all these images of like men on burning rafts, you know, big fur coats. And some Shakespeare as well. My dad always tried to read Shakespeare as if it was like to be enjoyed. And we used to act Shakespeare out. But I mean, something like King Lear and stuff. I mean, it was gruesome, really. So I think I was, aware of like a darker side of human nature. And my older brother always used to allude to it all the time. You know, you'll understand when you get older. And I just think, I'm going to have a vision of it. I'm going to reach an age. You know. But I think it really like probably a change of school. I mean, at 13, it is like, and plus it's like an age where you're forced into decisions about your future at 13. Like, are you going to kind of knuckle down, or are you not? You know, are you going to join like the ones at Nicholls School, or are you going to start taking it seriously? You have to say it's a point where you suddenly realise that you are going to grow up.
Is it disintegration and awareness of death and age and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah,
did you sit at school or at home and worry about that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Well, that's encouraging to know.
I don't know anyone that didn't. The disintegration, I think, that started off... the core of it was actually my what I felt was my mental disintegration around that age. I felt that I'd kind of peaked in my early 20s and I was like on my way out. And it was that's why I thought that disintegration was going to be a swan song. I thought I should never achieve these heights again. I'd never be able to rhyme two words again. and also my physical disintegration.
You've got books for stuff like that, Robert.
Yeah, I know. They have now.
The rhyming program. Dictionary. write them by rote.
I think that just the whole idea of like falling apart as well as you get older. You know, you're just aware of your physical limitations and that you can't do things that you used to do.
You've now moved on again to when you're 30 and you're thinking about this, aren't you? As opposed to when you were 30.
Yeah, but I think I think at 13 it's still kind of just like a vague kind of disquiet. It's not really a genuine fear. I don't think. I mean, like you write endless poetry, but I mean, I look back and I cringe. I've still kept some of like my old, you know, when I was really young, stuff that I wrote dreams and things and like that. Because I would never really, I would cringe. I would never show anyone, like, you know, I didn't trust. I wouldn't ever throw it away, and I wouldn't ever kind of dismiss it, because I've always had this idea of like myself at different ages, like key ages, and what I would think of myself now. So, you know, it's like a kind of Doctor Who theory. Mm-hmm. You know, the five Roberts.
Yeah.
And now you go, and it's strange, it's a kind of like set of checks and bars that are going to like keep me on this, you know, my own particular straight and narrow.
What would the 13-year-old Robert have thought of what I'm doing now?
He would be really, really pleased, I think, now. I don't think he would have been very enamoured of like the 25-year-old Robert. I think he would have thought he was a right dickhead, as the 35-year-old Robert does. The 30-year-old Robert was the scariest, though, without doubt.
30-year-old.
Yeah.
So you said that on the night of your 30th birthday, you went home back to your mum and dad. I just went completely off my head during the course of the evening. You mean you went out and got pissed, or what? What happened?
Well, I did a few silly things, really. I took some drugs, and it sounds really stupid, but there's a park, and I'd grown up there, and in this park they had a footbridge, and I'd always wanted to drive over this footbridge. There's like a gravel path led up to it, and it's an ornamental footbridge, and it's really steep, and it goes right up and down like that, like almost like a mono sort of thing. And then there's like this really steep hill ran down, and I used to play there like all through my teenage years, and for some reason I just had this idea it would be really, really cool, because it's like surrounded by a big block of flats and there's all houses and stuff. It's like a small gateway into the park, and there's only one small gateway out the other side, and cars weren't supposed to fit through. And I figured, well, you could definitely fit a car, because I once saw a car in there that belonged to the park, and I thought, so you can get a car through that gateway. And I started off in the evening, and it was quite early actually, it was about sort of like 9 in the evening, and I jumped in the car and I drove up to the park, and I drove through the gates and just went over, and I took paint off both sides of the car. That's how narrow it was to go to the footbridge, and lost the exhaust part on the tumble over and went out of the park. And because the park's really near my mum and dad's, Mary was standing in the driveway. I mean, she was screaming at me not to go, not to do it. And I came back, and
I can understand.
And then she got a taxi home, because she knew that it was going to be one of those nights. So that's how it started. So I thought I should do all the things in and around Crawley that I wanted to do when I was young, that I didn't dare to do. So I just went on like a bit of a spree.
Maybe it sounds to me like an inordinately sensible human being.
Yeah, well, she knew, she's like, she didn't stand a chance of stopping me. Mm. And she knew she's just going to get more and more upset. So she's seen it before. So she went home, phoned up the next day.
It's a good scenario for a movie, somebody who decides to go back to their town, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in fact, the things about, I mean, I knew I was doing it, because I knew why I went home. I went home in the afternoon, and I sat down with like my mum and dad and started talking about, you know, like when I was young, and my dad got homemade wine out, and I mean, I was completely bollocks by the time it was like 6 in the evening.
So did you tell them you were going to do this?
No.
It's got up on the
I remember screaming at the top of my voice when I was driving up to it, because I thought if I don't make it, this is going to be a really horrible jarring impact as the car like smashes into the two pillars on either side of the bridge. Mm. And so actually fitting through it, you know, it's like a real sense of exhilaration. It's like, yes, it's just one of those moments. Mm. I mean, you know, it means nothing.
But it was one of these things that because you were about to become 30, it was like, I'll either do it now or I never
will
do it.
Yeah, well, I thought that's, you know, this is my one excuse. When else am I going to, I mean, I thought, well, like, if I ever get to 40, I'm not going to want to do it anymore. And it's like, even at the time, it was fueled. That's, you know.
Has the town council sent you the bill yet for fixing?
No, it was in the paper. It was in the paper because the people from the flat blocks phoned the police, but they didn't know who'd done it. It was just a small.
What if they had found out who done it?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're happy to admit this in the book, then it would be great to get that cutting out and put that in the book. And say, it were me.
Yes, I better tell my mum on it first.
Okay. Well,
I remember when.
I'll put it in, you can decide whether to take it out
the,
or not.
The swimming pool at the middle school that I helped build was all the time we were there, it was like child labour looking back. They used to say, oh, you have a lifetime pass to go swimming there if you help build it. And we used to go there at weekends and dig the swimming pool. And I went back when I was about 15 and one afternoon, and they wouldn't let me in. I said, like, hang on, I've got a lifetime thing. And the headmistress who was there said, oh, you know, that wasn't, you know, if that was true, you know, we'd have hundreds of people in. I said, what do you mean if it was true? She goes, no, we had to say something to get, you know, parents to let all the children help. I said, this is despicable, you can't do that. So that I demand to be led to swim. She said, I'm terribly sorry, you can't come in. So later that night, I went back and I broke into the swimming pool.
This is your 30th birthday night again?
No, this is my 15th.
Oh, right.
And I just swam about and I didn't do anything, but I used a towel. I was quite drunk and I left the towel in a heap, and I thought I'd just kind of rearrange it, I didn't turn any lights on or anything, and I left all as it was, and that was in the paper with my mum. But they really blew it out of all proportion. They're saying like vandals hit swimming pool and like, you know, £35 worth of damage or something, you know, like towel left in shreds. And I was like, it's a lie. It was me on my own. I left a wet towel, and I remember my mum sitting there going, this is terrible, look, this is the pool that you helped build. And I said, oh really, oh yes.
Right.
In those moments, I could see her looking at me thinking,
oh, God. You were there just the other day, Robert. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. So what other bizarre things did you do then on the night of your 30th?
I went into Crawley Town Centre. I smashed a shop window. It was the other stupid thing that I did that night. And I shot the manager of whom had thrown me out few years before, mm-hmm. and I knew still managed the shop.
What, was this before you threw you out, before you were famous, or?
I don't think I'd ever been famous in Crawley, really. It was in my early 20s, so it was probably about 7 years before. Oh. It wasn't really a grudge either, it's just like it was a shit sort of menswear shop. Mm. I'd actually gone in with someone and they just chucked me out. It was like a symbol of all that I thought was wrong with like Crawley. But actually, what was wrong with Crawley was me breaking a window. It was pretty stupid. Yeah.
You could be in for a lot of bills if you print this.
Yeah. And that was it. And then I wanted to like just run around the park by the school that I used to go to. Just because it was.
What? There's a different park than the one.
Yeah. There's a park at the back of the school, but the comprehensive, and it was just like a. I mean, it was really like Dead Poets Society, really. It's just like revisiting, you know, like keep up, because I'd grown up in the same town, you know, for sort of 20 years. I just like wanted to go, I thought, like, one last time sort of thing. So I just packed it all into one evening. Mm. But, I didn't get up for like 48 hours. Shattered, yeah. Because I took my shoes and socks off and stupid things, that, you know, I thought, like, if I get arrested, I don't care. So I was like wandering through town. It was actually more like American Werewolf than.
Or you described it as English Werewolf with Crawley.
Yeah.
So you said you ended up about 6 in the morning just in a pair of jeans in the middle of Crawley trying to find my way home.
Yeah, that which was quite worrying because I realised that, you know, when you start seeing milk floats, you think, oh, it's time to get home. And it took me ages to get home. By the time I got home, there were like commuters. It's really embarrassing.
Mm. And he said, but it was good. I came to terms with a lot of things. Did you really?
Well, yeah, I'd got rid of a lot of idiot things that I wanted to do just in one night. Mm-hmm. That kind of, and the things that they're not, so even talking about them, it's not, they're kind of irrelevant, really, because it's one of those things I always find quite strange about being asked questions about, and I answer because I'm asked. But if I was normal, no one would, I would still have done it. You know, it's not because of who I am. And the only people that would know would probably be Mary and maybe Simon and a couple of other people. It'd just be like, oh, you know, remember that time you did such and that. When Mary remembers, it's just been a really horrible night. She lay awake all night worrying about, you know, what I was going to do, because she didn't know I wasn't going to, you know, end up the night with, like, throwing myself out of a window or something. But it was just, I had to get rid of, you know, they were just like, it was like a symbolic evening. Nothing that actually did meant anything, but I wanted to prove to myself that I could still do things without a good reason, I suppose. It was that one then. And these were just, they happened to be, you know. Had I been on tour or something, I would have chosen different routes. Probably would have ended up throwing myself out of the window instead of getting on tour.
Make sure it's a ground floor window. Always a good idea. Yeah.
I saw someone throw himself out of a ground floor window once. It was really funny. At a party.
Yeah.
They thought they were in a bedroom.
You thought they were upstairs?
Well, it was a ground floor flat. I was in a bedroom and actually threw himself. Like, pushed their head. They're trying to get out the window to throw themselves out. They said, but you could see roses.
Pretty feeble soothsayer attempt. Right, okay. No, that's kind of filled that night in a bit better. Because it just seemed that did seem to be a sort of a critical evening. And it did want a bit more.
Although the night I remember from around Disintegrate, that's the most vivid night. It was bonfire night at the studio, because I'd gone back and Mary had gone into hospital for an operation, and I went to visit her. No, I took her to the hospital and I left her there.
What was wrong with Mary?
She had something wrong with her eye. She had to have an operation on her eye, and she was really scared. And I took her to the hospital and I left her, and I came back to the studio, and I got a lift back to the studio, and I dropped some acid on the way back to the studio and went to a shop and bought loads of fireworks and had a really like wild bonfire night, and I felt so remorseful when I sort of came to the next day, because I'd completely forgotten about it. It's like terrible.
You'd forgotten about,
I'd forgotten
about Mary.
I'd taken Mary to hospital, and she'd already had the operation. I thought, it's that sort of self-loathing kind of fueled, you know, how can I be so horrible?
I mean, everybody does a lot of things that they, without thinking of what the consequences are, don't they?
Like
dropping out.
But I think some of the time I do things and I think, at the back of my mind, I know what the consequences are going to be. And I almost do them to kind of, you know, to try and break things.
Mm. Do you do things and to make your life difficult in order to have something to write about?
I think I have done that, yeah. Definitely, in the past. And looking back, I've done things that are like, I've had a choice between A or B, both equally as attractive, and I've chosen B because it's going to cause more grief.
Mm-hmm.
And for no other reason than that. Just to see what the experience would be like.
Can you think of examples?
I can, but I'm not going to tell you.
You're not going to tell you. I asked because, funnily enough, because Eric Clapton said in an interview with me that he'd done that, that he had ditched girlfriends that he'd been going out with for quite a long time in order to feel miserable enough to write the I've Lost You song. I mean, yeah, it's classic stuff.
I've never been that obvious, let's say, about
I thought it was very good of him to admit it.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, I think I can explain some of my more inexplicable actions because I think, at some point a good song's going to come out of this. But I don't think I wouldn't jeopardise my entire personal life just for the sake of writing a song. I'd rather not write a song. I think it's more that I would put myself in a situation that could be, you know, that could jeopardise, you know, other relationships or my own sanity, you know, just for the sake of the experience. But I don't think I've ever got to the point where I've Because I spent an awful time, when I was at school, my best friend's dad used to, I remember one Christmas I was round there and he would say to me, you're like the watcher. He'd go, all you do is like watch people, you observe people. It's like, you never join
Fantastic
in.
Fantastic Four, that yeah. watcher, yeah.
And I just like, thought, oh, and I thought no one noticed that I did it, and I used to do it. I just like, and I'd join in enough, you know, so people wouldn't notice. But I'd always be like observing, like seeing how people acted. And it's taken me years to kind of get rid of that and to actually like immerse myself in what's going on at the time. And I still find myself kind of like drifting away and just like watching. And I think, no, don't, because it's a terrible thing to like. Because you can, what I'm trying to say is you can end up kind of like living vicariously and actually just like taking material for songs and becoming a songwriter. Because that's not what I want to be. I mean, I would much prefer never to write another song and enjoy myself than, you know, I don't think, God, I've got to write a song, but you know, where's my angst going to come from? It's like, yeah. Because I don't have that need. I mean, the need to write songs, either, you know, it's there or it isn't. I think to kind of manufacture it is pretty tragic, really.
But I think this observing thing is quite, well, I hope it's quite normal, because I mean, I find that if you're in a group, like talking one-to-one, you're immersed in the conversation or whatever, and you know, two or three people, you're still immersed in what's going on. But I find that if I'm in a group of people, sort of six or seven people in somebody's house, I tend to slip into that role of, because you quite often can't find anywhere to logically interrupt the conversation. You're quite enjoying what's going on, so you sit and watch it almost like a TV programme. I mean, that doesn't seem to be wrong to me.
It's fine. You're on my side then.
Yeah, so, yeah. Well, just in case,
well,
you were worrying, just in case you were worrying about it.
He used to think I had some kind of ulterior motive for it, and I actually had very similar reason. I just like, I couldn't think of anything to say. I didn't see any point in really just like interposing to be part of the conversation, be part of the group. It was like everything's ticking over very nicely without me. You know. The worst thing is, like, I just read, in fact, the book that you gave me,
that
book, Trivia. It's got some excellent bits in it.
I gave him a book I found in this old, in Stratford upon Avon. There was this like little old lady that had like 10 rows of books. And they were all like dictionaries and things from like 1988 or something. But like at the very bottom, all dusty and dirty, was this one little book.
It's like hand published by a book called Logan Pearsall Smith. I've never heard of it. It's supposed to be his only book. It's like a kind of mini diary, just through a period probably of like 15 years, just like extracts from his thoughts on life and like his role in it. But that just made me think, well, I'm going to forget it now.
Sorry.
What was I talking about? Where did I get to that?
The book. Your best friend's dad.
Well, being the watcher. Yeah. And your best friend dad did think that was odd.
About not bumping into a conversation. Ah, that's right. I was going to say, he's got this just this one piece, so just like snippets in it, and something like, oh, once again this evening, there's a dreadful thing happening. It's like in a dinner party, conversations like going, ticking along nicely, and goats were mentioned, and I told the story about the goat at Portsmouth. Hideous silence, you go, and an even more dreadful thought. Every time goats are mentioned, do I really tell the same story about the goats? Of course.
I
thought, I know that thing.
See, yeah. I saw that book and I immediately thought of you with like all the just a little.
It's good. It's got some another really good one where it's really happy and actually, I won't sum them up because it's the way they're written. It's really good. But it just finishes at the end. He says, "How dare anyone say I'm drunk?" And yet the whole thing is like self-mocking that he's like at one with everything, and he feels really strong. Like he's really witty and stuff. And he actually knows he isn't.
I only read a couple of those little ones.
It's good. I photocopied like a load of about 10 or 15 pages out of it to give to you, which I think like the best things. The early ones when he's obviously younger are a lot more. Very worthy. Yeah. As he gets to older, in fact, they're really, really sad. The last few in the book, but there's some where he's kind of. It must be kind of like either early this century or late last century, because it's kind of it features vicars and bishops and stuff. And he must be quite well off. He moves in those kind of circles, but doesn't feel comfortable in it. And he's at another dinner party, and they're talking about Lord. You know, they put like Lord K. Dot dot dot. who's just young Lord Kay, he's only 21, he's just inherited a fortune, his father's just died, and he's inherited all the estate, and everyone's saying, oh, you know, it's terrible what he's doing with it, he's throwing wild parties and stuff, and they did the rounds, everyone was saying, following each other and saying how much more terrible it was and how they spend the money in much more worthy ways, and it got to me, I was just about to join, and I thought, well, what would I really do if I didn't know that? And he said, I think Lord Kay's doing a splendid job, but all this debauchery, it's wonderful, is it? And the look on the bishop's face, you know, you can't buy that book. It's excellent.
So if you get any songs out of it, you have to tell
me. I've got one already.
Which one?
I'm not telling you.
You won't tell me? You'll guess.
When you get the record, you will kind of and you read the first copy, you'll
see. So is that true, though?
Yes.
You have one song after
this. There's some excellent titles for songs.
See, Jane Granby is responsible.
Well, I know.
For this one.
Well, a couple of lines.
Okay.
Well, an idea for a song came from it. I just thought it was... The trouble with reading something like that is that he's actually put it far more succinctly than if you try and actually expand what he's reduced into one page and you try and make something more out of it, it becomes less, because the fact that it's really good is that he's just diluted the essence of, like, a moment.
They're
he's explaining
really short,
the stars to someone, to this girl, and he's trying, obviously, just trying to, like, chat her up. And he said, and he catches himself explaining scientifically what the stars are, how far away they are, and how long it takes for light to reach us, so they say. And he catches himself mid-sentence and thinks, this is all absolute nonsense, I don't know what I'm talking about. And just walks off and leaves it there.
Have you seen The Lion King?
I haven't yet, no.
Oh, you'll like it in that case.
If I stick my fingers in my ears when Elton John comes on.
Oh, forget Elton John, I mean, he's irrelevant to it. You're not even... I don't think he wrote the songs. I honestly don't think he wrote the songs. They're too much like classic Disney songs for him to have written them. So just forget all that. But there's a looking at the sky sequence that you'll love in that case. I mean, there's a very fun... I shan't tell you the punchline, but it's very like that.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the book.
Right, so forget disintegration for a bit. But when did you actually move out of Maidenville? Mid-1988, was it?
Yeah, well, we got married in August 88. That's when we moved out.
All right, so you got married when you moved out. You got moved out.
Yeah.
We're moving out, let's get married.
Yeah. He said, you have to tell him. I was talking, Jem called, and... earlier when we were waiting for you, and he I was just saying, oh yeah, kind of telling him what I had done. Well, yesterday I went down to Bognor Regis with Nick to go get Mary, and came back, so I get off the phone and he goes,
did you say you got married in Bognor Regis yesterday?
I thought I'd gotten married.
That wasn't
the case,
straight.
Hello, Dad. I got some good news. The good news is I'm married. The bad news is in Bognor Regis.
Were there any other possible titles for Disintegration? I mean, or did it? Was it always Disintegration? The album.
Was there another title? At the time, it was 1 million virgins kiss me, wasn't it? I think Disintegration was always Disintegration.
It was always Yeah. Okay.
In fact, the album title came before a lot of the songs.
Before the rest of it, yeah. Well, did you say in that last lot that you were saying just now, but when that title came to you, that was one of the things?
Well, I'm lying actually in here about the. I think, do I say that was the night I wrote Disintegration? That isn't true. Because I wrote Disintegration on whatever the tour was that preceded my 30th birthday.
Right.
When would that have been? Was I on tour?
Well, there was. Not long before you'd been in Europe on tour.
When Disintegration was? The tour? The prayer tour?
When was it 30? 1990.
You were 30 on.
91.
89.
September. I saw you in September of 1989 in America.
I was 30 in 89 because I was 59. I was one in.
You sure? Because I've worked it out as being April the 21st, 88.
I was born in 1959. I was one in 60. I'm always one ahead of whatever year it is.
So you're as good at maths as I am, then.
Yeah, so in 69 I was 10, 79 I was 20, 89 I was 30. 89.
But Disintegration came out in 88.
Yeah, that's why I'm lying when I say that I wrote the song on my 30th birthday.
You wrote it before it? Much before.
We recorded through October, November, December, January, February. 88 into 89.
Right.
I was approaching my 30th birthday when we were doing Disintegration. I wasn't yet 30.
Right.
So my cathartic 30th birthday, like, had nothing to do lyrically with what went on Disintegration because it had all been done. I was still writing words with that B-side and stuff, but the bulk of the album had been done. You there?
That one bites the dust.
Which one is this? This is the...
This is, I think.
The dancey one. I like this one.
This is a pop song, is it?
Yeah.
At the end of 87.
You just said the words to Disintegration were written on the Kiss Me Tour.
In their initial form. Right. Went for, like, after we'd finished the tour of America in 87.
Right.
And that was the start of, like, and through 88, I was doing home demos, and we were doing demos down at Boris's, and that's when I met you, I think,
right,
in 88,
right,
wasn't it?
That's when I was... Was that the first time? No, that was the second time.
Yeah, because you came
to
yourself.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Right.
Yeah, because we did two lots of demos at Boris's house in the summer of 88. Mm-hmm. And we started recording for real, I think, in September or October. Yeah.
Where'd you record that one?
What?
Kiss Me.
Miraville in France.
Great. Okay.
Oh, I love... you guys are from France. France, sorry.
France.
As in Chris France.
It's because it's got like Lullaby,
right,
and Love Song. And,
why, it's interesting.
But, you know, I mean, if it didn't have those songs, if it was the why it's like 100 times better than Pornography, I think, it's because it's got pop songs on it. Mm. Pornography didn't. And it's like... Because it's an old cliche, right, in a light and shade, but particularly with a record, it works. I mean, my favourite records, even like a Nick Drake, my favourite Nick Drake album is like Five Leaves Left, because it's got like Man in the Shed, mm-hmm, and a couple of other songs that kind of like lift you out of the morass. Whereas I think people say, oh, Pink, you know, Pink Moon's like his best record, but I mean, it's too uniform, kind of.
Totally.
I don't know, because you can't see how sort of gloriously tragic something is unless you like, you're laughing one minute. I like all that. It's like really good records kind of like drag you about a bit. Like,
yeah.
It's like good horror films always have very funny bits in them as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the combination of the two that really gets your emotions seesawing around.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I think that the a song like that is there, well, apart from the fact that I think it's just like a really catchy sort of song, and I like listening to it, and it puts me in a good mood. I can imagine like listening to that next summer and kind of thinking, oh, that's not, it is good to be alive.
that's what I like about this one. It kind of feels like that.
Yeah.
Kind of like,
and it's nice. And some of the other ones at the same time, I could think, well, they'll suit me when I'm feeling a bit.
Yeah.
It isn't.
You always stress that the importance of a song is the emotional content, the emotional commitment. Presumably, you put the same emotional commitment into a song, whether it's happy emotion or miserable.
Yeah,
emotion, or
the thing is, I remember driving home from the Wish, when we were doing the Wish album, it was getting towards the end, it was like after month four, and I listened to the tape of what we've done, and I thought, what we really need is like a really catchy pop song. And that night when I got home, I started singing to myself, and when I got home, that just sounds like a really corny story, but I actually wrote Friday I'm in Love, and I thought, while I was doing that, I was thinking, well, I could sort of
music
hear
or lyrics?
The music, and I thought, oh, this is going to be a really catchy song. I sort of knew it, because the tune had stuck in my head all the way home, despite the fact I was listening to things on the radio, and I thought, that's a good sign. And the next day, as I was driving back to the studio, I thought, right, I've got to convince them that it's a really good pop song. So I thought, what should I sing about? And I just thought, oh. And it was actually a Friday, and I was thinking, oh, I'll sing about how good it is. Because I felt really good. So I got this really good song done at home, and I was like driving back. I was looking forward to it. We were going to the pub, and I thought, it's a great Friday. And that's like the germ of the idea. And I wrote it in like about half an hour, which is really extraordinary, because I very rarely write anything like that. But it took ages for me to get it right when I was singing it. Not just like lyrically, but actually like to make me sound right when I was singing it. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't get it right. Like, there's other songs in the album, it's like 10 times more difficult to sing, you would imagine. Like Trust or something, really, you know, like very emotional songs. I just couldn't get Friday. I couldn't get myself into the right frame of mind. Every time I came out and listened to it, I thought, you're faking that. You're not that happy. And it was right near the end. And it's like really throwaway. In fact, we'd already started celebrating the end of the record, and I was going to do the vocals, started sitting in another studio. And I thought, God, I could sing that song now. I just had like one of those feelings. I went and I just like did the whole song in one go, and that's like the song suddenly, you know, it was it. Everyone's like, oh, that's it, that's the pop song. So in some ways it was contrived, but in others it wasn't. So you're right, and I couldn't do it and think, oh, well, you know, we'll get away with it because it is, you know, it's got a catchy tune, the lyrics work, it's going, you know, it'll get played on the radio. But I thought, I want to be able to listen to it, and that's what I always think about what we do. I thought, if I listen to that and it doesn't make me happy, then what's the point in doing it?
Yeah.
Whereas now I've listened to it, and I hear it, and I think, and it actually makes me smile, because I think, oh, I remember doing that, and I was in a really, really good mood.
See, I think that's why.
So if I wasn't, I'd...
That's why I think I like the really, I enjoy the really happy ones, because when I come over and I have such like an incredible time over here, I'm usually, you know, it's like my happiest time coming over and doing all this for a week or whatever, and so the songs kind of remind me of being, you know? Maybe that sounds really corny as well, but it's true.
But everybody has songs that remind them of time,
yeah.
People and places, and it's great, we live our lives by them.
Yeah. But I mean, I still do with that. I mean, like you keep your book. I mean,
yeah.
When I do a vocal, I think that's it. I only get one chance. You know, once this record's out, I can't go back and say, I didn't mean to do it like that. I want to do it a different way. I think I have to like know myself, and I listen back to it in years to come. That's, you know, I remember doing that. I can remember doing almost every vocal on every record. I can't remember like hardly anything about it, anything else to do with it. Like, when did we decide on that snare drum sound? Well, that's like completely irrelevant. But the vocals, like for me, it's like the key part of the record. It kind of makes or breaks the songs. I mean, some songs we've done have been really good, but I just can't get the vocal right, and that's it. You know, their lives stop there, sort of thing.
Mm. This is presumably where the cassette of instrumental stuff came from, isn't it? Because that wasn't intended. That was things for which the vocals presumably didn't.
Yeah.
But they were such nice pieces of music, you didn't want to lose them.
Yeah, well, we did. When we set out recording the Wish album, we were intending to do a second album, like concurrent, of late night jam sort of stuff, which never came out. Although we've got a couple of things I've done really excellent. I've got on DAP, which is like sort of like 2 hour. Just bashes, you know. So with the DAT, like
2 hours.
The DAT runs out, and we're still bashing away. It's
good,
like,
God.
We've had a couple of those here, actually.
Actually, the Grateful Dead here.
Yeah, a couple of the drummers have been well into it, and I suggested that we had one night. We had one night, just me and Perry, didn't we?
I was dancing. That counts as something, doesn't it?
Yeah, one of the drummers. We played till about 8:30 in the morning, and he went off to do a concert.
I went to bed at 7 in the morning, and I think you guys played like a half an hour
rocking.
And a half an hour longer, and you had started before dinner, because for the first, and you did like 3 tapes before dinner, then we had dinner, and then I went back in, and you played until 7.
I enjoyed myself too much at night.
I think you went to bed, Perry said you went to bed about a half an hour after I did, but then I went to bed about 7, a little after.
Are you getting more back into playing guitar, because there was a phase where you kind of less than...
I have to.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm tracking.
There is no one left.
Yeah. The other option is to audition more guitarists.
No, I mean, I like, again, it's one of those things. The funny thing about the Wish album is a lot of people thought that like all the guitar solos and stuff was Paul, but in fact, they're all me. I just let's do it under the cover of Paul so I didn't get ridiculed, you know. And Paul did it on stage, so which suited me fine, because I just couldn't do it on stage. I mean, I couldn't do that in front of people.
Why not? What's the difference?
I feel much more self-conscious. Like if I was to do a guitar solo, if I'm in a forest, I can live with that because that's an adventure. But, you know, like things in, you know, when Paul's kind of like, he's got the right moves and stuff. You either can or you can't do it, and I just can't do it. But in the studio, that's really good.
I love your guitar playing. I really enjoy your guitar playing. I love Paul playing as well.
I remember on the Kiss Me tour, we opened with the Kiss, didn't we? It was like all a wild sort of frenzy workout. I used to really enjoy doing that because it's like heads down sort of music. But, that's what we were doing the other night. I'd done a song here, which is just like 5 minutes of me playing wild. But in fact, I did that on the Wishbone as well.
Yeah.
Cut.
Well, there's a bit in that track where. Quite far on into a couple of minutes into it, where there's a lick comes in and it's so you.
Yeah.
I couldn't replay it to you now. I couldn't tell you what it was, but it just comes in. And it's like hearing an old friend. It's like running into somebody unexpectedly. You say, "Oh yeah, that's Robert." But it's nice. It's a really nice feeling. There's quite a lot of the guitar player that's going on there that could almost be any good guitar player.
Yeah.
But every now and again, something comes out and you go, "Oh yeah, that's definitely him." It's nice.
No, I do. I'm relishing playing guitar. I must admit on this record, because they take the piss out because I've got so many guitars and I've never played a lot of them up till now. It's 30 odd guitars with like
rain. Really,
I
didn't realise you had a big collection.
Yeah. So I just come to tell you my very unfunny joke for the day.
Yeah.
What's Bruno's favourite soap?
Hang on. I don't know.
Home and a gate.
What's Bruno's favourite soap?
I'm in the way.
These jokes are in the way of a kind of test. A challenge.
I don't know what Home and Away is. It's a programme on television.
Yeah.
Oh, a soap. Oh, I was actually going to say coal tar. I was trying to think coal tar, palm olive.
Yeah, I was thinking of Roger and Gavin.
Actually. Soap hot for Rosie.
Good.
Thanks.
Right, guitaring. Yeah. So is it a more guitar album?
No. Strange enough, this record I had a really fixed idea of what it was going to be like.
Mm.
When we were doing the demos in the summer, and it was like the song we heard before this one. Kind of like fluid basses. Boris was just going to use like brushes.
Breakfast cereal with cocoa puffs.
Boris is just on brushes. It's almost kind of it'd be like an entirely acoustic album. In fact, I'm like my touchstones were Nick Drake and Van Morrison. Like Astral Weeks was like another one. I'd like a few records.
I was listening to it actually. I was thinking folk rock.
Yeah, and Joni Mitchell was another one. I think they're all some nice, some unusual chord changes for us, just like expanding a little bit into like an acoustic area. I thought I could really go with that. That's how I felt in the summer. I was just, that'd be nice to sort of sit next to an hour's worth of that. And then all this sort of happened with Boris, and then I started doing these demos, and it's not really as a reaction to Boris, but suddenly there was like all this like weird music coming in, and like there was that, you know, it's like pop song, there's like machine music, and I thought, oh, here we go, it's all running out of control again. And the third lot of demos that we did without Boris was actually quite revelatory, because we reused just like machines to run the percussion and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like we've got like three lots of demos. We've got one towards the end, in fact one exactly a year ago, to see if we should start thinking about doing another record, because I thought it was a really good song. And we did some in the summer, and then we did some just before we came here. And they're all completely different. So it's just like a complete mix. I think the record's going to turn into like a very strange mix of songs. There's like a couple of them that are just keyboards.
So it's not going to
like no bass,
the
no guitar.
That you envisaged.
No, it won't be
anything
like
ever.
It.
I mean,
Disintegration was.
Disintegration was.
Yeah, that's the only one.
That was what?
That was how I imagined it would be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't let anyone change it.
Mm-hmm.
But with this one, there's just so much stuff. I mean, we've demoed about 50 songs, and we've recorded 23 so far. And of those 23, there's certainly there are sort of five or six that definitely have a feel to them. and I could still turn it into the album I wanted it to be if I did like another five or six in that vein. But then, like I was saying earlier about light and shade, I wouldn't be able to use a song like that. And I think, well, why? You know, what am I trying to achieve? It's like,
well, you have
that
to
song
that
will
one.
Make like the song before it work, because, I mean, the song before it's good. Like, I mean, there's some songs where there's a couple of like, 8-minute songs, and by the end of it, you need something like that to so you can just sort of, and then you're ready for like the next bit. You try and put 2 8-minute songs together, and like, very few people can pull it off. You've either got to be an extraordinary, good guitarist or whatever, you've got to be like a virtuoso to kind of hold someone's attention, or you've just got to build on a mood. And I, you have to like want to do that to pull that kind of music off. You have to like feel right, and I don't feel like doing that sort of music. We did that on the Wish album. That's like the couple of songs that we haven't, you know, of these 2-hour jams. There's stuff in there that's kind of just like, you know, it's almost not there. And you can hear us chatting, but one of us is sort of keeping playing, and it gradually picks up, mutates, moves on. It's like, it's really good. It's just like a communal music, and it was something we had never done before, never ever jammed. I'd never allowed us to jam, it's like my freshest rules, because jams always deteriorated into standard fare.
Didn't the band tend to jam without you, though?
Yeah, when I disappeared.
They would go off into rooms, wouldn't they?
What's been the saving grace is that
jam.
Simon can't jam. I mean, he still can't. You have to like write the notes down for him. He just cannot do it. So it's kind of, in some ways, it's saved the group from like endless jamming, because it's too much trouble. You know? So when we jam now, I play bass, give him a guitar, you know, just turn it up.
With Teddy. A song.
But it's also been quite good on this session with them having different drummers come in. You know, each one of them has been completely different, like personality-wise, drum-wise. Some have been really up for it, others have been very kind of like laid back, trying to impress. A couple have been very nervous. So that's been good. It's kind of expanded the way we've worked anyway, because I've had to think about what drummer gets what song to try and why, and what do I want out of that song. And so it's actually, I'm thinking about the songs in a different way. Normally I just like leave Boris to get on with them, and I'd come down and like listen to his finished drum track, and I'd say, I don't like that particularly, but I'll live with it. Whereas this is like I'm having to be there, you know, all the time, kind of encouraging them, discouraging them. From
It's a good drum sound on that one.
Nice,
it's very
loud. Yeah, that's
hits you.
Mark, who's all about Eve's drummer. Sort of half know anyway. Incredibly loud drum, the loudest drum I've ever met in my life. You could hear him like down the bottom of the road when he was playing.
Yeah.
It's like very worrying. We had to kind of cut off much earlier with him. But a couple of drums are barely audible in the control room.
I like the sound of him. He's good. Where did you go on your honeymoon?
I didn't have a honeymoon.
You didn't? Because in the paper you had just jetted off on your honeymoon at the end of the wedding. I presume that's something that the local newspaper invented because people do jet off on their honeymoon after weddings.
We actually, we jetted off to, we stayed in the same hotel the night before as the night after.
Right.
We were the last to leave our wedding. It's the only way to do it.
That's not traditional, right?
You're supposed
to slip quietly.
I laid in like all the music was on video cassette and stuff. I thought I'm not going to miss it. I even had like the last song planned. I thought that's it. It was all timed so the last song fit, because they wouldn't serve us drinks after 2 a.m. so the last song went on. But that was it. I was away. Everyone waited till our car had gone and everyone followed. Then we went to my mum and dad's the next day, stayed there for the night, and then we went home. Well, I mean, it was a honeymoon because we moved in to a new house.
Yeah,
so it's
right.
Like, yeah, by the sea.
So you didn't feel the need to go away and have a
break? Well, I just can imagine like, doing this. Is not going away is really excellent.
Right.
We're just about to start recording, the other thing. I think I had like 2 days in the new house and then went down to Boris's, actually.
Well, because I got confused about, again, it's funny, you get all these cuttings and you think it's all going to make sense, but it doesn't. It doesn't. You're reading bits, well, where does that fit in? You know, why doesn't that interlocking with that? There was a holiday that you went on to south of Dublin.
Yeah.
And that was before you got married.
Mm.
where you sat and watched the scene? And,
from 18...
And it didn't feel good.
87, 86. I should know this. It was all the court case was all about this. At some point in 86, I think it was, I decided to take a year out. In fact, it must have been...
Well, 86 is pretty much the last book came.
Yeah, it was December 86, actually. We signed a new contract with Polydor. That's what all the court case was about. Mm-hmm. And I was advised that if I could manage to stay out of the country for 10 months out of the following 12, mm-hmm. I would be entitled to not pay tax.
Oh, right, yeah.
One of those scams. And so we were touring for, like, 7 months, so I had to kind of find...
Somewhere to be
for 3 months. And you can only stay in ERA for like 3 months, and then you have to start paying them tax, I think. So I moved into this house with this woman and this bloke for 3 months.
Where was it?
And Mary came over to visit me. It was just south of Dublin, in a place called Dalkey. She was a very nice lady.
Dalkey, yeah.
It was a very nice house. I just used to kind of get the ferry backwards and forwards. You're only allowed a certain number of days. It's, one-sixth of the time that you've had out, sort of thing. So I had to, because I think Simon and Carol were getting married, so I had to kind of time, so that because I was best man, I had to have enough time left to go to be back for that. And so Mary was with me up until their wedding, and then we came back, and then I went back on my own, and I stayed there on my own for about a month. I don't know why, actually. I don't know why she didn't come back out with me and ask her.
Why don't you come on your
time? Come on, we're
here.
Remember 987?
Day in your room tonight, we know what's happening.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's right, 87. I've got it as being sort of round about July 87. That's right, 2 week holiday now.
Yeah, well, it was like a bit, it turned into, I mean, we made it into a holiday, kind of, because otherwise it would have felt like an enforced exile sort of thing.
Right.
I was just hoping. The thing was, I was never really taking it that serious. I thought if anything goes wrong, you know, like if there was like illness in the family or anything like that, I was going to go home. I told my accountant that he's going, "Oh, you can't go. Please don't get to month 9." I said, "But how can I? I don't want anything to happen, but if it does, then I'll have to come home. So it'll all be wasted." But we've kind of spent 7 months touring around the world, so it wasn't any big deal. And in fact, staying in Ireland was quite nice. It was a break, and there was no phone in the house. I had to phone the office from a call box at the station when I wanted to speak to them, which is like once a week. So it was perfect. And that, just that Irish place life, over a period of 3 months, I really chilled out. And
that's
a California term. You're not allowed to use that.
Have you been to Ireland at all?
No.
Well, I kind of chilled out by the virtue of the fact of drinking like 8 pints of Guinness.
It's
the
Guinness.
Like
it's the Guinness. Other thing I like about Ireland is it's an incredibly lively music scene almost anywhere in Ireland.
Yeah, although I didn't...
People playing in...
I went to... That's what I was going to say. I didn't go into Dublin at all, but I went to this one pub in Dalkey that had like live music every night. Mm. I just used to go there and just like sit at the back table.
Usually... country and western songs or whatever, but there's music everywhere in Ireland. Everywhere. Music.
Yeah. The best thing about this that I remember in the interval, people would have brought along, you know, it's like a guitar or a squeeze box or something, and they would fill the interval with music, and they'd say, "Oh, quiet, quiet," you know, and the main act would be back. And it was all just felt really natural.
Punters would just.
Yeah, like no one was showing off. It was just kind of, they were just like, they didn't want the music to stop. Yeah. There's no jukebox, and so they're kind of like filling the gap.
We've got a pub near us in Pusey where people can just go along on a Tuesday night, take the guitars and sing. And they all sit around a fire. It's really nice.
Yeah.
Good atmosphere. But,
you should go.
I'm not good at doing things like that.
I know, I'm teasing.
Was it when you were in Ireland that you, can you remember, that you read Sartre's Road to Freedom trilogy? That's a very specific question.
Yeah.
I only want to know because I do want to try and relate books to periods.
Yeah.
If I can. I just think from something that I read that was probably
one of them. Iron in the Soul? I can't remember the name. Mm. Iron in the Soul? What are the other two? I can't remember.
I don't know what they're all called. I haven't read it.
I really don't know. I mean, I remember I had a suitcase of books that I took to Ireland with me, and that's what I did. It was just like went and sat on the rocks and read books.
Right.
I tried to read all the books that I felt and the people thought I had read. and I felt I should have read.
Can you remember any of them that you did read?
It probably was. I remember reading a lot of books that I didn't enjoy, so I'd imagine that I read Roses of Freedom on that particular trip. I didn't really enjoy it. I do know what I read I read the complete works of Nietzsche in Dalby. Red and Black, whatever it is, and Beyond Good and Evil.
That's right. You mentioned Beyond Good and Evil at the same interview that you mentioned Road to Freedom.
It was all around the same time. I was kind of wading through to try and make sense of them. Who was right and who was wrong? Because I was given a book that was called something like Great Philosophy of the Modern Age or something, and it had like a short piece at the front about philosophy up to like the 19th century, and then detailed chapters on what they consider to be the main philosophical giants since 1820, some arbitrary time, started off by someone who was completely unintelligible to me. His thoughts and it's all to do with water and very bizarre stuff. I remember reading through and trying and comparing, actually making notes like I was back at school in the margin, and having a notepad and trying to make sense of this web of thought and who sort of got there. And I realised that I'd only attempted to read Beyond Good and Evil when I was at school and I hadn't liked it. I just thought it didn't say anything to me as opposed to Camus or Sartre, which I actually genuinely enjoyed. And so I read all of Nietzsche, and then I realised I hadn't read anything by Sartre apart from his books like Nausea, and which are really good. And I did read Roses of Freedom because I thought it was pretty awful. I didn't think it compared at all. In fact, I'm just about to start rereading Nausea. I've got that upstairs this morning.
I think it's quite, it's very you. I mean, the whole reading books, a lot of you grows out of things that you read and things that you think about. And I think it's quite important, to say that when you were in that place, on that tour, the books you had with you were such and such. I just like that.
Well, you could probably, if I should be bothered, I suppose, I could just probably trace a line lyrically from also Sprach Zarathustra through to something on disintegration. There's bound to be something on it. It's
you can think of it.
If I dig out my copies of them, I always bend the bottom corner, corner page down to something of interest, make a new sort of thing like that. This is just a phrase. I don't feel bad about nicking phrases. This is like balk at nicking entire ideas from people, but.
But everybody
nicks,
don't they?
Yeah, I he's a really good writer. I just very skeptical of what he writes about. He's brilliant, the way he puts things together, brilliant composition. But it does get you start reading things. I would be sitting there on the rocks and I'd read, and I'd get to the end of the chapter and I'd shut the book up and I'd look at this. What the bloody hell am I doing reading this? And I'd just stop now.
Are you one of these people who has to read to the end of a book? I mean, if you start a book, do you?
I have never not got to the end of a book, doesn't matter what it is. So I'm very wary of picking up books that haven't either been recommended to me by people that I can trust, or they've been given to me by people that I can trust, or that I read a good review by someone that I can trust. Because I know if I pick up a book and I just start reading the first page, that's it. I'm in. It's there's a thing upstairs, this boy sent me his first book, and it's about five times as thick as this, and I've had it now for about 3 months, and on the first page inside, written in Byron, it says, I know that you won't start reading, so I know you'll never read it, because if you read the first page, you'll be forced to read to the end, and you think it's going to be shit. That's it. And he's right, because I've just looked at the first couple of sentences and thought, no.
Somebody know about this, yeah.
But I can't throw it away, I've still got it, because he wants it to be, he thinks I should start a publishing company for struggling young writers who are Cure fans, and they'd all buy each other's works, and therefore I'd get the money back to them.
Just like that nice Paul Weller.
Yeah. There's a sort of logic to it.
Yeah.
Cure fan series, he goes, as long as I'm number one.
You've obviously not got enough to do with your money, so. Was there any truth in the theory that in 1987, when you started the American tour, you had to be barricaded into your hotel on the first night and hire 12 sumo bodyguards? Or did you make this lie up?
Did I say that?
No, you didn't say it, but it was reported. It was reported in a fairly downmarket tabloid, like the Mirror or something like that.
Yeah, I think I'm trying to remember Arrival in 1987.
It was around the Catch had just been released in England as a single.
Ye================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================================ hysterical tour, all in all, as I remember.
I mean, you would remember having 12 sumo bodyguards.
No, I don't know. I definitely don't remember that. Well, I wouldn't actually, because I'd be the other side of the door and I'd be completely oblivious to it.
So, what, somebody else might have hired them without telling
you. Yeah, I just think there's like a lot of poop in the corridor. I'm like looking through the spine and thinking about any minute. They just look big anyway, don't they?
There's a lot of men in nappies outside. It's alright.
There's nothing new there.
It's the American sex convention.
You're staying in the cruise hotel, it's like.
It's like that all the time. Okay, and it's just one of these stories that I think has to be cleared up.
Perry might remember, because he was on the crew for that, so he's probably better to remember.
Right, okay.
Anecdotal material from that tour. As long as I coach him to be very careful about what he does and doesn't remember.
That was also the tour on which you played Madison Square Garden, but was it the tour on which the doorman at Madison Square Garden didn't actually recognise you? The band, didn't know who the band were. Which is something that you did say in an interview.
It must have been, because we've only played there once.
Yeah. Can you remember the incident? I mean, can you actually remember the doorman not knowing who you
were? I remember arriving at the...
It was one of these interviews where...
I remember it being difficult to get backstage. We actually got into like a holding area, and this bloke wouldn't let us into the dressing room. And Mary's cousin is this blonde-haired girl. She's really like a brassy bottle blonde. You know, see, that's like that. Comes from Doncaster. And she appeared from on this huge boat. She said, "No, it's all right. That's him." And it's like one of those surreal moments. I'd only ever met her once in my life at a wedding. I kind of dimly thought, "That's Mary's cousin. What's Mary's cousin doing in our dressing room, Madison Square Gardens?" And she was there on her own. And she'd made a sandwich from like the rider. And she'd opened a can of beer. She was like sitting there chatting to this enormous security bloke. And he thought that she was like the artiste of the evening.
Wonder.
And like she was letting us in. Yeah. I remember walking in. And
you
everyone was kind of like, no one said anything, because they all thought, well, she must be something to do with Robert. She's like, you know, she talks in the right voice. She's like one of his family. Like. And I just like sat there and I said to her, her name's Carmen. I said, Carmen, how did you get back here? She goes, I don't know. Because I just kept walking through and everyone was just letting me through. I kept saying, "Oh, yeah, I'm cure, I'm with Cure." And they just thought that she was an artist called Cure. Because we were just reaching a kind of level there where, well, we hadn't reached a level there where people knew who we were, really. And she'd got all the way into the inner sanctum.
When you say you hadn't expected her to be there, I mean, did you even know that she was in America?
No, she was there on holiday.
And just turned up?
Yeah. It was her last night there, and she's just like, so. And she'd left her friends in a bar and come there on her own to ask me if she could get some tickets for the show. Right.
And had managed to get all the way through.
Yeah,
so
she
much,
is
so
one of those girls that could do that, you know.
Yeah.
She's just like.
So the guy's giving you a hard time,
yeah,
and it's only her say so that gets you in. They're okay.
There's a classic moment. We've got like an entourage of like 10 of us, like big Brian with this. What's going on? Remember what's going on?
I liked your imitation of him quite a bit.
But this bloke was seriously big. I mean, bigger than Brian.
Oh, that's
big.
It
was like double door sized man. They're very, in a place like that, they're very, in fact, more fanatical than they are in some of the much bigger places, some of the Madison Square Gardens. Like the people that run it, very proud to be working for Madison Square Gardens. It's got kind of a prestige, whereas like other, even bigger venues, people are much more kind of like laissez-faire. There's so many people wandering about backstage at like a football stadium that they give up. There's like 30 different kinds of laminate, so they just don't bother. If you're wearing anything that glints, it's like you get through.
Oh, there are certain places, aren't there, which have a certain prestige about them. Madison Square is one of them, Carnegie Hall, places like that. They have a thing about it.
We played in Mexico, and we weren't allowed backstage in Mexico because we were told we had the wrong laminates. There were so many bootleg laminates that the real laminates were considered to be the fakes.
Oh,
classic, right?
Classic Mexico.
Where was that, in Mexico?
Oh, yeah.
Where in Mexico then?
Was that on that same tour? Or?
No, that was on the Wish tour, wasn't it? when we went to Mexico, the first Naomi time.
Was it, but you were, like, close to Texas, right?
Yeah, it wasn't Mexico City, it was the one, what's the other big town? Is it?
Chihuahua.
There's something about it.
El Paso, no, it's Texas.
Monterrey.
Monterrey, it happened in...
Yeah.
But it's Mexico City, just living there, like one day there is the equivalent to smoking 2 packs a day.
That
was just bizarre. There were about 600 or 700 people in this backstage area. It was like a football stadium. And they were all wearing these fake laminates. And there was only like our little entourage, or 10 of us with like the real McCoy. And the bloke wouldn't let us in. And it's only sort of like dimly became aware that we were like talking in the, you know, in a foreign language. And we just arrived on a fucking humongous bus that maybe we just were who we said. And so then they proceeded to try and round up all these other people with fake lemons, and they spent about 5 minutes in and thought, oh no, it doesn't matter. So then they just like barricaded us into the men's toilets, and everyone else just carried on as normal. It's like, it's really bizarre.
You always end up in the toilets anyway.
Yeah. But this was actually in the urinal.
The real
The only place with one door and a one door. And if we weren't barricading there, there was no way we could go to the toilet. So it was like, it was the best place to be. The thing is, they'd been packing people into this stadium from about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and all the sanitation had gone, all the water had run out, sort of thing.
Oh,
it was
Mexico
just too many people
there,
it was all blocked up. It absolutely stank when we went on stage. It was almost enough to make you heave. It's like 40,000 people.
So, are you going to go there again?
No, there's no go there.
There's some gorgeous bits. Did you go down south in Mexico at all?
No, that's as far as we got. We did spend, we drove around. But never really got far enough away from the urban centre. Not like in Brazil, we never actually went out and saw the country, because we just kind of like, we headed down there, we played, we came back. But it was a very interesting 3 days, but not really 3 days I'd like to experience.
To repeat again, you should go to the Yucatan down south. I mean, it is just fabulous. You'd love it. Well, anybody would love it.
Yeah. So we didn't have enough time, because we were doing it by bus. The others weren't prepared to spend the extra 2 weeks to drive all the way down. I got hit by something on stage, as the other thing, so by a door handle.
In Monterrey or in Mexico?
In Monterrey. I just remember I remember seeing this object come through, and just at the last minute I moved my head back, and then sort of like everything going black for a couple of seconds, and coming to, kind of like staggering about. No, I'm just like, I sang the next line. I only missed one line. The Trooper. Great photo of me after sort of the blood cakes on my cheek. It was really hard.
Unfortunately, the line he sang was from "I'd like to teach the world to sing," yeah. But it was a line.
I'd like to see that.
What the hell? It's a line. It'll do. They'll never notice. They're Mexicans. what's her name's being sued for at the moment? Oh no, it's Happy Mondays are being sued, aren't they, for pinching the tune of "I'd Like to Teach the World to Sing."
Are they?
One of their songs apparently lifts it. It's terrifying though, isn't it? You stole the melody of "I'd Like to Teach the World." Anyway, right, so we ended up in Mexico. I don't know how we got there. From Madison Square. Oh, laminates and all that stuff. Getting backstage. Well, that's a good little anecdote. In the week of Madison Square Garden, you also, I think it was the same week, you played a charity gig at the Ritz in New York.
Yeah.
What was that in aid of? I can't remember. A charity. Okay, doesn't matter.
Bill will remember that, actually, because he set it up. I think, if I'm right, it was all to do with the Canaan Arab scandal. And I think it was in aid of homeless Arabic and Jewish American children, half and half to each.
You'd just been
put a disclaimer, and I'd had to go and like tell the Arab community it was nothing to case over. But then we couldn't just give the money to homeless Arab children. No, it was Arab orphans in New York. We had to do it to Jewish orphans in New York as well. Yeah. Otherwise, we'd have them on our backs. The excellent concert that was actually. I think it was the last night of the tour. I remember not completely ratted.
And Lol did his famous solo version of "Wild Thing," I gather.
Yeah. Just purely for our amusement. The crowd just didn't have a clue what was occurring.
What was going on?
But it didn't matter by that time. Remember, we just sat outside in a minibus for about 3 hours before that concert, just drinking. mm-hmm. like listening to music on the stereo, because the club is just so packed, and like, you know, the Ritz is just, like, the backstage area is like that corner. We just couldn't face the prospect of going there, so we just literally went just straight from the van onto the stage. Mm-hmm. And so it was really.
Why were you there 3 hours before? I mean, had you been rehearsing that earlier or something?
No, it's just like we wanted to go to. I always like to get there early, like Simon does as well, to kind of get a feel for the place, like see what the mood's like, see what the crowd's like, see what you've got to expect, and you know, see if you're going to have
see
to work hard.
Like.
See what the van's like. But it was just so packed already that we didn't bother going in. Mm.
But it was a good gig.
I remember it being quite funny. I remember sitting down on stage watching Noel doing Wild Thing.
What did he do?
Just chatting with people in the front row. Wild Thing.
It's he's saying it.
At certain points in the low points in our career, he has sung Wild Thing on stage. Yeah. 3 times, I think, he's done it in total. And never again.
I've never actually seen this event. I mean, what is significant about it?
Well, it's just
abysmally
awful. Because all he knew was like, Wild Thing. Hard Sin. Everything. Groovy, and then he could never get down, 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 down. He'd always come and sing it at the night. He would go down, down. You make it go. Oh, it's like da 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 da. It was funny for us because it highlighted his lack of timing, which is why we liked it. Mm. Lots of gaps in it, lots of stops.
Reg would have been proud of him, I dare say. Yeah. It was probably the way they did it as well. And it was shortly after that, I think it was in September, that Roger joined. Was it?
Boom.
87.
And he'd just come from a stint with the Furs.
Roger joined earlier than that, didn't he?
Well, again, this isn't entirely clear from what I've got.
No, Roger definitely joined early in that. Roger,
I think you gave me Roger's number anyway. Sometimes.
Roger joined for the Kiss Me Tour, because Kiss Me Tour, Roger was on it.
Right.
All of it. So he joined actually in Dublin while I was still in Dublin, because we had the tour rehearsals in Dublin in about April 87. The first thing Roger did with us, I think, was April or May 87. He was with us throughout that year.
I don't know where I got that from. I got that from the Guinness... Who Rockstars book or whatever it's called.
There's a lot of misinformation about Roger Jenner and everything that's been written about us. Mm. People kind of muddy up that time. Because the reason why Roger was brought into the group is because Lowell couldn't play any of the keyboard lines on the Kiss Me album, so we had to get someone to play keyboards. That's why I know that he was... And we finished recording that. And we did the cut in February of 87. Mm. So it must have been between February and May of 87 that Roger joined. In fact, he came and it was the Tube he did with us or something, one of those programs.
I'm not even going to have to read the book.
Yeah, to know.
Oh, you're just going to get it all right here.
You've got all the facts. Can you remember if that was around the time that at the end of that tour that you decided that you were going to do a solo album? Or had that idea been around for a lot longer?
A lot longer. The when I was originally going to do a solo album was actually when Simon left the group, when we ended up doing Let's Go to Bed and The Walk and those songs. I actually did demo 4 songs that I've still got on a tape for my solo album. So that's when the whole thing started, because I've got now about 2 hours worth of stuff. Most of it, actually, I reviewed it before we came here. It's pretty turgid. I don't think I'm going to use it. I sort of think at the time I liked the idea of it because it was very kind of like small and you know, naive and kind of like inconsequential, just didn't mean anything to anyone else and I didn't want it to. But now I sort of think it would be contrived for me to do that because I'm not the same person really. So they just sort of, I think those songs are just there. But I think from time to time through the years I've kind of like had a dissatisfaction with the group, whether it be with the lineup or like my part within the group, or how I perceive like my role in the group, and I just throw out the idea of a solo album to kind of shock people, so like, I can do it on my own.
It's there.
Get back in line. It's my cracking of the whip. It's a solo album. Oh yes, okay, yes. Yes, we will play in 4-4 time.
Play it that way, yeah. Play it that way, or I'll release the soul bomb. Now, here's a really vital question, Robin. Just before you went off on the European tour at that point, Just 17 magazine revealed that your essential travel kit included Crimson Sculpture Mary Quant lipstick. Is that right?
No.
It wasn't Crimson Sculpture.
Crimson Sculpture.
Scorcher. See, I thought that. Scorcher.
And I still use it.
I thought some of these things sounded wrong. All May Eye pencils, and something called M.Y. McCombs hair gel. I'm not a great user of hair gel, so I wouldn't know, but McCombs doesn't sound to me like a...
No, I can't remember what it was called, but I used it at the time.
We'll just say hair gel.
It had a hexagonal design on the front, and it said things like pH 1 form, you know, it's like dead scientific.
Oh, yeah.
Just like glue, basically.
I love all these things.
Blue glue, excellent.
Do you have some of that? We can fix the painting.
No, I now use a different. I use green glue now. I don't know what it's called either. L'Oreal, I use now.
Oh, you look. Animal testing.
Is it?
Yeah.
It's the only stuff that stays up on stage.
Mm.
I tested it on myself. Cool. It ran into my own eyes, Jane. I promise you, the stuff that didn't work. I can tell that they tested it on animals because this stuff runs into my eyes and it doesn't hurt.
These things that makeup.
I know, this is going falling very flat with you. I know, which
I love all these things that you get in.
You're going to have protesters. Robert Smith, I'm going to let it out. You have the pet of protesters.
Let's move ahead here to October, European tour starting in Oslo and then Stockholm. I mean, do you have any particular memories of that tour?
What, the Kiss Me tour?
Yeah. That's right, the Kiss Me tour. It started in Oslo. I mean, you talked here about...
Where are you now?
I'm on page 2 at the moment. Yeah. Halfway down, about getting up at 8:30 in the morning, which I presumed from what I read was in Stockholm, and going out and watching people go to work and making you feel good, what have you. Does that bring any memories back?
Yeah, although I my main memories of the tour was the first tour that we started videoing. We bought a video camera, mm-hmm. and Perry would video the audience. I remember all through that whole year.
Oh, was it just the audience research thing? Yeah. Asking audiences?
Yeah, of sitting backstage watching the audience. Like Perry would come in at half an hour before the show and kind of put it on fast forward through the boring bits and say, oh, this person's got something good to say, you know. And it was really good. Like, it would get the whole group round. You know,
that's what I'll
it.
Do on the next tour.
And we talked about
that'll be my
what
job.
We were going to do. And it actually like really helped like the group performance. I suppose because Roger was like a newcomer as well, and I was trying to like make everyone feel like part, you know, part of a group. So he probably felt like a little bit left out. Mm-hmm. I also remember that was when Simon constantly tried to make Lola before we would go on stage.
Tried to
make him up with various
things. Make him up, right.
He'd always suggested like particular kind of go, Lowell, this would look really good, like really trust me, and Lowell would be just on the point of being drunk enough to trust him. I know that you're going to do something horrible, but go on, do it anyway. And he'd like sit there, and Simon would do like, you know, like a V on his nose, or he'd like do really, really heavy eyeliner, going down here, like, or he'd accentuate his jowls or something, you know, with blusher. And we would just laugh, you know, it was one of those in-jokes that the more it was done, the funnier it got.
Do you think a lot of that, I mean, because Lowell became the butt of a huge number of jokes, do you think a lot of that was by way of trying to get him to make his own decision to leave?
Yeah, I mean, it set a huge number of jokes, but I think, I mean, it was primarily Simon. I mean, it was almost exclusively Simon. And it stemmed... not
Simon's like, war against Lowell.
Well, it stemmed from when me and Simon and Lowell were a three-piece, and Lowell was like a normal human. And played drums and contributed and understood what was going on and talked lucidly and was a nice person to have around. And when Simon rejoined, Lowell had friends in the city who drove Porsche cars, flashed his money about, was a boring wanker. And Simon, and it took like 2 years for that to happen. Simon came back and was, I think it was like born out of kind of, he was like utterly distraught at what Lowell had become. And his way of battling it, of like all combat, and it was just like to have a go at him at all times, at all costs, you know. But he did it in a way, it was, I mean, a lot of it was like, it's really sort of stupid, it's like banal. Some of it was genuinely surreal humour, and some of it set up things just so that Lowell was going to get it at the end of it, you know. I mean, so that's all that, it's just like constant. I mean, one of them survives to this day, where Simon laughs in the theme tune to Hawaii Five-O. But yeah, I can't. I mean, he's and he just gets louder and more manic, closer and closer. The pointing it would get at the end, and he goes, "All right, Lol," and then just walk off. And Lol would just be like, be bemused, as we all were. I don't have no idea why it was Hawaii Five-O. But it's Simon, something had happened that had triggered it. And there were loads of things like that, or things like Tattoo from Fantasy Island. Mm. It was all like just like trash culture that Simon kind of weave in very tenuous links just to have a go at Lol. But I mean, but Lol deserved it, really. But it didn't come from anyone else. I mean, Boris would kind of like, if Lol was being like drunk and obstreperous and kind of like leering all over him, would be like, Boris would just fuck off Lol. That would be it. That would be Boris being horrible to Lol. It would be short, sharp, and, you know, cheerful. And Paul wouldn't even bother saying anything. Paul would just like hit him if he, you know, I mean. But Lol could be really obnoxious. Well, physically, part of the Bamonte conspiracy that's taking over popular music. And he, I think Severin is kind of, you know, a bit, not really envious, but I think he used to like ridicule me in a sort of half joking way, as all did all the banshees, about the fact that I would stay, you know, that Mary was my girlfriend and that I led like a boring conventional kind of existence and I should get out and about, all that sort of mentality. And I could never see it, and I just thought, well, I get the best of both worlds from what I'm doing. So I've got like a best friend that's always the same, that I can always talk to. And I think I've ended up kind of, well, I mean, I feel I'm vindicated. I sort of think that they, well, I mean, Sue and Budgie are married now, so it's nice.
I don't know,
well,
I mean, obviously it works well for them, but I just always, as a group,
well, musically,
I just
always felt there was a waste of time.
I could never understand.
I think Budgie's excellent. I really think Budgie's a really, really talented bloke. I think it's pretty wasted in the matches. Mm. Severin's just, Severin's made a career out of being Severin. Mm. He's alright. He's got, you know, similar kind of chip though about talking to people that aren't someone. Mm. I don't know, I don't like that mentality. Really. I could put up with it. While I was in the benches, I had to kind of like swallow it, you know. Because
yeah.
Otherwise, I would have been rowing all the time. As it was, I just rowed like once a week. Because they were always really horrible to Mary. They used to, like, I couldn't bear. But they used to do that to wind me up. It was a great pleasure in winding me up.
I think that was what I didn't like about it, was it didn't seem to me to be appealing people.
No, they're not really.
The kind of people just didn't think you wanted to be around. But I did interview them once, and I interviewed Susie, and I thought she was completely weird.
She's that
strange girl.
She's one of the most intellectually pretentious people that I've ever met in my life.
Yeah, anyway, this is irrelevant. Let's get back to Lol. Another charming soul. What I was trying to get at is, was the slagging off of him and the making him the butt of jokes? I mean, was it just that, just slagging off for its own sake, or do you think Simon?
No, everyone wanted him to leave the group.
I mean, because there's two things that occur to me: that leave the group,
yeah,
or get your act back together and become a human being again. I mean, was the hope that he would be pushed into one of those two things?
I think it was left up to me to get Lowell back to normal, back to being a human being. And it was like, and if Lowell didn't choose that path, it was kind of up to Simon to make sure he left the group. It was that sort of, you know, that was the balance.
Definitely.
That was sort of like there. But the thing was, I mean, I used to offer Lowell like counselling and friendship, really, like right the way through to, in fact, even while we were still at Brushford doing the disintegration stuff. I remember sitting at the table with Lowell there and saying, well, this is really like your last chance. If you don't stop drinking now, you're going to be out of the group whether I want you out of the group or not, because there isn't going to be a group for you to be in or out, because everyone's going to leave. But I mean, it all started...
Everybody else was threatening to leave.
They would have left.
Because of,
yeah. I mean, if I hadn't thrown Lowell out of the group, then the others would seriously, after that record had been made, would just have gone. They weren't going to go on tour with Lowell again none of them could say that, nor could I really. I mean, but I just sort of had more sort of pity than the others, I suppose.
I knew longer,
and I kind of remembered what he was like. And I suppose I deluded myself longer than anyone else that he could become that person again. But Simon and was kind of egged on by Paul, really.
The making of the videos. Can you remember anything? You were saying how you would sit and watch the videos, and there would be things on them that were interesting, and you know, people saying interesting. I mean, can you remember any particularly interesting things that punters said that appeared on those videos? Or was it only interesting at the time?
It was only interesting at the time, because you were kind of... Because you knew those people were like there, but they were only like 100 feet away through a few walls, and you were going to go out and play to them. And there they were, just like moments before, and they were like talking. They were talking to the camera, talking to you. They were saying, "Oh, Robert, you know, what do you think about this? Oh, I know you'll never get a chance to answer, but like, if you could say something down the line, can you wish so and so happy birthday?" Just really little things, but it was really good because it made you.
And did you do those things?
Yeah, because when you went out stage, you actually felt like you knew some people in the audience, and it made the whole audience kind of like.
Were you ever able to sort of address people by name because of?
I used to cheat and take notes out on stage.
Yeah.
Actually, I used to give them to Jimmy Olsen, the monitor man. It's not his real name, needless to say.
No.
and
Clark Kent, the lighting technician.
And he would hand me these notes that would say, you know, "Don't forget to wish."
So
some people would sort of say, "Oh, he's so charming. And what a memory." Be there going.
Traditional thing is to put it on your wrist, isn't it?
Yeah, but then it'd be in a photo. What's he doing? Why are his veins like that? But mainly it was just Perry would ask them like what songs that they would want to hear that we might not play. And he'd like pick out Cure fans, ones that like obviously look like Cure fans. And we'd try and like chuck a couple in the encores. It was really for that, but it kind of developed into this sort of ritual where we'd all get round the telly and like and talk about the performance for half an hour. And I found it really, you know, it enhanced what we did an awful lot. And I think that sort of when I began to feel Lowell wasn't really part of the group, because Lowell wouldn't do that. He'd just sort of, fancy her, you know. It'd be that, and you think, oh, there's Lowell, can you come on, you don't need to say it. It's dead obvious. It's Perry's like, having a video conversation with one particular girl for more than 5 minutes. Deep down, he's thinking, oh, she's
God,
nice.
Isn't that nice?
He was thinking, well, why is the ratio of girls to boys always like 90% to 10%.
Why is it always the attractive girls that get on the video?
No, he wasn't like that. He was very fair. In fact, he would stand there and not anyone that wanted to come up. You two took it to stage with him by actually putting a booth around their man with a camera. No, it's good. I mean, the thing was that we had to stop doing it when Perry got in the group. This is not. It was because it was Perry doing it.
Yeah.
That people actually would feel at ease and would actually talk to him, you know. He'd kind of hold the camera on his shoulder and just, he can talk to anyone. He's never seems to be stumped.
So it was a valuable run.
Yeah, I mean, that's my overriding memory of what's made that tour stand out, really. And also the shirts, we all were matching shirts, white shirts with different, we all had a different pattern from the catch sleeve on our shirts. Which I thought was really cheesy. I was used to like, and that moment of like of everyone putting their white shirt on with their pattern. We said
well,
there was
before
like,
you go on stage.
Yeah, there was like a good kind of like in joke about that. Very Reservoir Dogs actually.
Follow the Cure database at tcdb.info. That is tcdb.info.